Welcome to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology, brought to you by the Media Economies and Design Lab at CU Boulder. I'm your host, Stephanie Abdallah, and joining me on the program today is my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Naima Buradi, an artist, journalist, and academic who has recently earned his PhD from the Media Studies Department here at the University of Colorado. His research explores how immersive technologies can be harnessed for cultural preservation and as tools for imagining alternative futures. Dr. Abradi is the co-founder and co-director of the Phoenix of Gaza XR project, an interactive virtual reality experience that documents life in Gaza by highlighting its culture, history, and resilience. The project has been showcased at major institutions in the U.S., including the MIT, Harvard, Princeton, Brown, and Yale, and internationally, having been exhibited in the Netherlands, Canada, Uganda, South Africa, and Spain. Dr. Abradi is also a Data Justice Fellow at Princeton University's Ida B. Wells Just Data Lab, and was recently awarded the prestigious Mellon ACLS Dissertation Innovation Fellowship. In 2024, he was the recipient of the Graduate Student Activist Award from the Activist and Social Justice Division of the National Communication Association, and his work has been featured in major media outlets, including the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, BBC, WGBH, The World, Atmos, and Colorado Public Radio. Our conversation today will focus on the importance of virtual reality for immersive storytelling, both outside and within the classroom. We will talk about the limits of empathy when technology seemingly breaks the wall between human rights violations and audiences, and how VR can help us challenge these limits, enabling us to engage with narratives more critically. Naim, I'm so happy to have you with us today. Welcome to Looks Like New.
Thank you so much for having me.
Naim, I have seen a couple of your exhibits, and storytelling really is an intrinsic component of the work you do. You narrate very personally your trajectory growing up in Gaza and wishing to go abroad to pursue your studies in journalism. Your work, however, beyond personal, is extremely political, and especially in the past few years, has taken massive proportions. Could you please share a bit of your story and how it has shaped your work so far? And how has storytelling been an important tool for you?
Again, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity, you know, to share my work and also my story. I grew up in Gaza, and as you know, Gaza is not like any location in the world. It was a very tough life for me. I grew up in like a small house with my family in Gaza City. Most of the days we did not have electricity. I survived the three wars that Israel started in Gaza. So when I remember, you know, these days, it just, you know, despite all these, you know, tough memories and this, you know, rough childhood that I lived in Gaza City, what I remember is just like people all the time found a way to create life out of nothing. They found their way to, you know, create happy memories and to create life and enjoy life with whatever they had. And so I am, you know, I just tried, you know, to make life there. And despite all these tough conditions, like personally, like, and you know, I lived like, you know, with, you know, as I said, like, you know, in this small house, I couldn't even afford sometimes to go to school. But at the same time with like any Palestinian in Gaza, I just came to the world with Israeli blockade that started in 2007 with wars. Like I remember the first war was in 2008. But even before I was, you know, I faced the first time to see an Israeli soldier was in 2007. As I remember, I was visiting my aunt who used to live in a small village that's close to the border that the Israeli army controls. And when we were about actually to leave, and in that day when the Israeli army invaded that village. And they entered the house and they put all of us in one room next to the snipers. So they made, like, you know, the house as, you know, a sniper's point where they would, like, you know, there were, like, almost 30 Israeli soldiers in that house. And they would, like, you know, and they put us, like, in a small room next to there. I did not understand at that time why they put everyone in that small room mm-hmm. next to, you know, the Israeli the snipers. But then I realized that we were used as a human shields because, you know, if any attack came from the Palestinian side to them, we would have been attacked first. And that was really a tough time. I remember I was like almost like 12 years old. My aunt's name is Naama. It's the female name of my name, Naeem. And one of the soldiers actually found it funny to the extent that he took his gun, and I was sitting to my aunt, next to my aunt, and he pointed his gun at me and my aunt, and he kept, like, going with the laser. It was, you know, a red laser at that time, like, you know, red laser, red light coming from the gun. And he kept just pointing it at me and Naama. She's like, Naama, Naeem, who should I kill first? And that, you know, was the first memory. Like, this is the first time to encounter an Israeli soldier, because all the time we see them, like, you know, attacking us from the sky with the airplanes. They can watch us, like, all the time from, you know, the drones that were there 24-hour, 7 days. But, you know, to come, like, face-to-face to them, that was my first time. And then the war started in 2008, and at that time I was just leaving my, you know, my exam. I remember it was, like, with my friends in front of the house, we actually were talking about the exam, like, how you did do and blah, 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 blah. And out of the sudden, it just, like, attacks everywhere at the same time. We kept running. Some of my friends were killed in those attacks, especially those who were, like, late leaving from the school. And then, you know, in 2012, there was another attack. In 2014, there was another attack. In 2008 and in 2014, actually, our house was attacked. So, you know, living with all these memories for me, you know, when you see all of that and you just look to the news and the media, and especially, like, the Western media, you don't see any of that. You know, you see just the other side, and Palestinians are misrepresented, and no one talks about us. So for me, like, just, like, you know, my personal story and my personal experience also became, like, you know, an encouragement for me to seek media and communication. So I just wanted to study journalism in English so I can tell the story of the people of Palestine and what's going on there, and just focus on the other side, you know, how people created life out of nothing, how they resisted all these wars, about all these happy memories that happened in Gaza before, like, despite, you know, the blockade, despite the wars. Until, you know, I finished high school. In high school, you know, we have this standardized test. It's called Taujihi. It's like the high school standardized test where everyone in the country should take this exam every year before you go into college. Usually 40,000 students would take this exam. And my family's economic situation was not that good. So I know that I cannot afford college, even in Palestine. So the only chance for me is to get the presidential scholarship. And that scholarship is given, actually, to just only the 10 top students in the country. And usually, like, 40,000, you know, compete with this. So it's almost, like, impossible. And I did not even have, like, a place to study in. So my desk was, like, you know, created from old refrigerator. And I built, like, a small tent next to the house to study. But my goal was, like, I need to get there so I can get a scholarship and a study. And, yeah, I made it. I got, like, 99.4%, and it was the third top student in the country, the second in Gaza. And I was like, you know, I was a star for a whole week, and wow. Just like, you know, media talks about me and stuff, and you know, and just like, oh, I'm gonna be like the journalist that you know, I have been dreaming of becoming. But corruption, you know, I did not get that scholarship. And, you know, when you look, if some, and many students who have, like, you know, connections to the government or someone with, you know, with power, they were able to go to college, but I couldn't. So I started actually working in a internet cafe for almost 6 months. I couldn't go to college. I worked there until I applied for different scholarships. And I remember at that time, one of my teachers actually introduced me to the Washington Report on Middle East, and they wrote a story about me. And then I got a scholarship to study in the U.S. And I was like, excited. I'm going to go and study journalism in English, and I'm going to do what I've been dreaming of. It's just, you know, to work as a journalist, tell the story of the people here. But again, another war just happened, you know. It was 2014. And the war was like, it kept going like for almost 55 days. And I was asked to wait for another year so I can apply again for colleges here in the U.S. But at that time, I was like, you know, there's nothing there. And I got another scholarship to study in Turkey, at Istanbul University. And I just decided to go to Istanbul. I started studying journalism there, but in Turkish language, which was another challenge for me. And I worked in social media, like, since I was a free, like, when I started to repeat. So I got a scholarship to study at Istanbul University, and I went there, and I started studying, you know, media, but in Turkish language, which was another challenge for me. But the good thing is Istanbul has a lot of opportunity, so I started actually working when I was a freshman. Mm-hmm. So I started working as an editor, and then I was promoted to be a social media manager in my second year. And we would like doing, like, you know, campaigns to target audiences in 22 Arab countries. And there, when I saw, like, the dark side of media, and I felt that I was distracted from my dream and my goal, because I wanted to focus more on what's going on in Palestine, tell the story. But, you know, with that project I worked on in Turkey, it was like more of, you know, away from what I'm trying to do. So I decided to quit in my last year. And that was 2018.
Okay.
And then I was invited to come to the US and give talks about my story. I came and I gave talks like in 30 cities here in the US. In the last talk, actually, I was introduced to meet my advisor, my former advisor, Dr. Ahlam Muhtasib, when she encouraged me to apply to the graduate program in communication studies at California State University, San Bernardino, which I did. I went back to Turkey, but then I came, you know, to study, to do my master's degree. I did my master's degree. I was studying, like, the misrepresentation of Muslims and Arabs and, you know, especially Palestinians in mainstream media. But that was not enough for me. I wanted to do something beyond just, you know, critical analysis. I wanted to create something to tell the story. And in the last semester, actually, I was introduced to a grant from the X-Real Lab at Cal State San Bernardino. It's a $3,000 grant, and usually to help students use immersive media for their research, for their work. So I proposed the idea. I was like, for me, you know, it was, at that time, it was 6 years since I left Gaza. So I just wanted to, like, you know, it just, like, it was about my own pleasure going back home, mm-hmm. to cross all the borders, to cross all the blockades, and just be home and just revisit all these happy memories, all these, you know, locations that I miss, all these, you know, landscapes that, you know, I was forced to leave behind. And I was like, what if I use 360-degree cameras and, you know, VR to go back?
So that was the beginning of the Phoenix of Gaza XR,
yes.
Right? Which you co-founded with your former,
yes.
advisor. Before you continue that story, I'm just curious, did you know back then what this project was going to become? If you can explain to our listeners, what is this project?
Yeah, well, as I say, you know, when I started the project, I proposed the idea, and it's just like a simple idea, you know, I want to use 360-degree cameras to capture the city that I love, the city that I miss, and share it with everyone. And then when I proposed the idea, Dr. Ahla Muhtasib was a fellow at that lab, and she loved the idea, and we started working together on that. When we started, is the challenge, again, it was not only about us as humans, as Palestinians, to go back home, but also the camera, the technology, was not allowed to get in. So it took us 6 months to get the camera into Gaza. It was not allowed. We sent the camera to four countries to trying just to get the camera into the city so we can start filming. We were not allowed, and we had to wait like for 6 months until eventually we were allowed to get the camera in. And when we started filming, we hired a journalist named Ahmed Hasaballah. And Ahmed was my friend. We grew up in the same area. And I would ask Ahmed, can you go to this place and just film it? And the first location was Hammam al-Samra. And Hammam al-Samra is like, you know, an ancient public bathhouse from Ottoman Empire. And I wanted to see it because I never, you know, I heard about it a lot, but I never had the chance to go because I couldn't even afford paying to go and visit when I was in Gaza. And it would be crazy, you know, to for someone to in a war zone just to go, you know, to a public bathhouse.
But through the camera, you could.
Exactly, right? So I went back to Turkey when I was in Turkey, those, you know, public bathhouses, they are really popular. And I love them. And it's like, what if I see that? I want just to be there. And he filmed it and he sent it to me. And, you know, when he sent that, there was something different about it. You know, I just viewed it and you can look up, down, you can look on the right, left. You can enjoy all these details of that place. You feel that you are there. You are not watching from behind a screen. You're not watching from a distance. You are not reading a story. You become part of it. You are there. You move your body around just to look at it and see it. And to be honest, I cried, you know, just seeing that place. And I cried from happiness because that was powerful. And I don't think we have any other format of media that can give you this sense of reality. And then I wanted to see more. So I would ask Ahmed, can you go to the beach? And can you capture, you know, like this a beautiful beach? And then just I would ask Ahmed about normal stuff, you know, that people usually do in Gaza. Like, can you walk on the street? Can you go to the market?
So you could feel at home again.
Exactly. You know, just like normal daily life activities, you know, and then the more Ahmed sent me, the more I wanted to see. So I kept asking Ahmed to do more, just to go in the car, to walk, to go to all the historical locations, to the museums, to the churches, to the mosques. And for me, when that idea was about me, but then I realized there's something powerful here. Me and Dr. Ahlam, we now need to share this. Mainly, our focus was with Palestinians who cannot access their home, including those who are from Gaza, but also for other cities, because Israel doesn't allow for any Palestinians to move between cities, between the West Bank and Gaza. And if you leave Gaza, it's hard for you to get back. So for me and Dr. Ahlam, just like, this is important because this is almost the only way now to share, for people to access their home, to be immersed in that environment, to see the culture, to enjoy all these happy moments and joyful activities in Gaza. So we wanted to share that, but also we wanted to share it with everyone, because people, when you say Gaza, it's all associated, all the time Gaza is, you know, shown and portrayed in terms of violence, destruction, war.
Stereotypes which are fed by mainstream media, by the way, right?
Exactly. Especially mainstream media here in the West, in the U.S. So people don't know anything about, you know, the other side about Gaza. So they know about it in terms of destruction and war. So we wanted to share the other aspects of life in Gaza with people here so they can have, you know, a big picture of what's going on there. But also it was an attempt to challenge the mainstream media and their stereotypes about Palestine and Gaza. So we kept filming, and then we started sharing the content, especially with my students in the classrooms. So my students would do the experience, and they would relate to it. They would relate to the ice cream shop. They would relate to the pastry shop. They would relate to a university. They would relate to all these normal places. They loved it. And I had some students who said, "Oh, Gaza looks like a city here in the U.S. and we never, never thought about Gaza from this perspective." Mm-hmm. And then I realized that also now we need to go back and capture some destruction, because students also need to know about that. So we hired Ahmed again, and we asked him to film the destruction. But we wanted to film it in terms of hope and, you know, resilience. So we captured the destruction with a graffiti on the wall. And then we started sharing, and the students would relate to it, would reflect on an ongoing situation through this immersive media, which is a unique experience for them. You know, it's not only they are watching and getting immersed in that environment, but they also study how this technology is utilized for immersive storytelling, for journalism, for communication. And to build all these cultural bridges between Gaza and the rest of the world. So that was an important for them as an example of how we can utilize technology to help people. But we were actually about to release the project in October of 2023. So we were done with all the showcases, with the demos that we had, and we were ready to release the project. And to be honest, like, we never thought in our wildest nightmares that we were capturing history, that everything we filmed will become a memory. Hmm. Everything we filmed is destroyed. Ahmed would call me and tell me, like, you remember the Amri Mosque? It's gone. You remember the Church of St. Porphyrius? It's attacked. You remember this market? It's gone. You remember the museum, Qasr al-Basha Museum, which is like the largest and the oldest museum in Gaza. It's like, it's gone. I survived the 3 wars in Gaza, but, I never thought that Israel will dare to attack these locations, because they are like symbolic places in Gaza. They are like the main locations. But, it was like, heartbreaking. It was very tough for me and for Dr. Ahlam and for any Palestinian, actually, to process what was going on. So we couldn't even look at those images that we filmed and the videos that we have. All of us have like pictures from their childhood, and you keep them and you preserve them and you put them like on your wall or whatever, because you want to keep these memories. Mm-hmm. So for us, we couldn't even look at these happy memories, because we just started questioning, like, who lived a life from these people, how they are doing right now. So it was hard, to process all of that. And we just focused on my family's safety, because my parents and my youngest brother were in Gaza. So trying to get them to safety in the center of the city. And then I had to evacuate them to, Egypt, so they can be a little bit safer. And my dad got sick, so he needed medical treatment, because most of the hospitals in Gaza were destroyed. So for me, I was trying to process all of that while, trying to help my family to get into safety. But then we realized that we are holding something important.
Because the images that once were just ways for you to remember places that you had been now had become the only images that exist about these places.
Yes, so the project that aimed to share the Palestinian happiness, to share all these, memories, all these joyful moments in Gaza, took like a tragic direction. It became an archive of the whole city. And not any other archives. It's an immersive archive, the only multidimensional 360 footage and videos of the whole city. So for us, it was like a big responsibility, but also a burden to have all of that. We view it as, all of these videos and images belong to the Palestinian people, not for us. We are more of like tools to tell the story and share it with the world. So for us, we were holding this, you know, all these happy moments. Israel were able to attack all these places. They were able to kill people, but they cannot kill the memory. And that's the most important thing for us as Palestinians, because Palestinian archive, Palestinian sculpt, Palestinian culture, Palestinian heritage has been subject to continuous Israeli attacks. It has been a subject for, you know, to erasure. And this is one of the ways to preserve that culture, to preserve that history and keep it alive so people can access it. People who are from Gaza and people even from the rest of the world, so they can access and see how Gaza used to look like. Mm-hmm. And I'm also thinking about the next generations, like who will never see how the city used to look like. But now with virtual reality, they are not only watching or, you know, seeing, they can immerse themselves in that place. They can embody someone who's walking or biking or skateboarding or even like on the beach. So they can enjoy these moments and connect to it, which is really important when, you know, physical archives are destroyed. Mm-hmm. When you know, people cannot access that location because of the borders and the blockade and what's going on there. So virtual reality and immersive media here become survival tools for us, you know, to access, feel, imagine our home.
Absolutely. And I really appreciate you sharing the story of this project. For the listeners who are just joining us, we are hearing from Dr. Naima Buradi, who is an artist, journalist, and co-founder of the Phoenix of Gaza XR project. And Naim, your account of this project's history demonstrates the transformative potential of virtual reality, as you very well mentioned, both on an individual, but also in a societal level. So personally, this technology has been a way for you to engage with and remember your home, despite geographical and political boundaries, but collectively and especially in the last few years, as the world witnesses the genocide of your people and your home, the 360-degree images that your team has captured have become, as you mentioned, documents of Palestinian history that resist erasure. Can you speak more about the possibilities that are enacted through VR? What does this technology offer that other media do not?
Yes, thank you for this question. Well, first, it's an you know, the power of immersion. So, you know, once you put the VR headset, you will be isolated from your physical space and you will be immersed in a total different area. You can walk, you can bike, you can run, you can dance with the people there because of this. And this is really powerful because, you know, without that small device that you put in your head and on your eyes, I don't think we can deliver this type of, you know, immersion and this type of realities, right? For me, VR provides us with the closest sensation to the physical reality. So it gives us the closest sense of reality. And we don't have any other format of media that can do that. Now, even VR is getting advanced every day. So now with VR, you can touch objects. You can hold them in your hand. You can look at them from all, you know, the
angles.
Sides and the angles. So you can look from up, down. You can hold it. You can see it. And, you know, you can feel it. Now, even we have a smell. So now, yeah, some devices that can convey the smell, how, you know, and this is, you know, a totally different thing from, you know, watching a video on YouTube or, you know, or listening to a program or on All right, so it's totally, you know, it's huge. It's a new format of media that, you know, you are immersed in a totally different place. And by the way, this has been a concern for many people. Like, you know, when you talk about virtual reality, is like, you know, the first concern that comes to mind, especially for critical scholars, is it's, oh my God, like we are already on our phones all the time. Right, like we spend 5 to 7 hours every day on our phone. We are isolated from reality. We are distracted from many things. And people are just like, now with VR, oh my God, like when you put the VR headset, you will be, oh, totally isolated from your physical space. But let's think about it from a different way. What if we use virtual VR headset to isolate someone from their privileged physical space so we can immerse them in a totally different space where they can feel in other people's pain, or they can feel how people experience life. Yes, sometimes it's painful, but we need to convey that. This type of media can help us to deliver this kind of feeling when you are fully immersed in a totally different area, so we can feel in the suffering of other people. Because in the US, we are really privileged. You know, people here are privileged. They did not experience war. They did not experience what it means to live in a city that, you know, under blockade, that you cannot leave. You don't know what it means, you know, to have F-16, you know, attacking a place next to you. You don't know, like, what it means to have a drone 24/7, like, you know, under continuous surveillance. So with VR, I can take them out, you know, from their privileged, environment, and just put them in that space so they can feel what people are experiencing there, which is very important, not only in Gaza, but you can now measure this and you can apply it anywhere. Like, people don't know what it means to live in Mexico, for example, right? With VR, I can immerse them in that environment. People don't know how, you know, indigenous people lived back in time and what they experienced. Now with VR, I can revisit history and take them into a specific moment of history, of time, where they will be immersed there. Like, you know, for example, like we are here today at University of Colorado Boulder. This university was established on indigenous people land. Mm-hmm. Imagine if we have an experience, VR experience, that show people how the indigenous groups, tribes lived here and what they experienced. And add this, like, you know, on the university website or whatever, where people can just put the VR headset and that. So this is important because it connects people with the history in a unique format of media. One of the, you know, the popular examples that, you know, demonstrate the power of technology of revisiting history is Traveling While Black. It's a documentary about the Jim Crow based on the Green Book. And it's really powerful because it takes people to that time, and it makes them feel what it meant to be a black person at that moment of time, and that, you know, racist moment of history. So with VR, you can be immersed there, you can see how people live their lives, which is really important. And the director of the film actually said something, as I just said, this is like with VR, people cannot escape. So the director of that film actually said something really powerful. Said, once you put the VR headset, you cannot escape it. It's the same way we cannot escape our blackness in the US. Mm-hmm. Right? So this technology, you know, again, this, you know, this advantage of like VR and, you know, the fear of VR, you know, the fear of VR that is going to isolate people from reality becomes like really a powerful tool to help people, you know, imagine and experience what other people live, how other people live their life and they are suffering. And as I said, like the Phoenix of Gaza, you can look at Traveling While Black. So, and we cannot do this with any format of media. So just to go back to your question, and this is one of the points, is the immersion. The second thing, which is really important, is with virtual reality and immersive media, because immersive media is not limited only to virtual VR headsets. We have also, for example, physical planetarium here. It's an immersive space where people usually go there to watch, you know, stars, to watch, you know, space and astronomy. But also we can use that space to reflect on current situations. For example, I did my show there. I called it Reclaiming Our Sky.
Which was wonderful. I watched it.
Thank you for coming. And thank you for your kind words. So that, Reclaiming Our Sky, so for me, as someone who lived in Gaza, looking up is a privilege. You know, just like you cannot look up because it's like the sky usually it's full of like drones, full of airplanes. All the bombs come from there. So for me, it was a source of horror. But when I came here and I saw, I actually went to the planetarium as a teaching assistant to a class, media and history class. Just went to the students and when I saw that power, I was just like, what if I use this space to build Gaza sky and just sit there? And that's what I did with the show. We were able to live stream Gaza Sky, the stars, but without the drones, without wars, without F-16s. And that's the powerful aspects of immersive media. Is it help us to imagine our presence and our future, mm-hmm. you know? And we cannot do that this with any other technology, you know? It gives us all these tools of, you know, that can help us to imagine ourselves, to reclaim our visuality, to reclaim our right to look up and enjoy our skies, and or be immersed in a fully in a different place once you look up, once you are under the dome. At the planetarium. So it just that's another thing powerful about virtual reality. And the third thing is it's really people found that increased empathy with marginalized communities, which is really important, but it's a little bit risky too.
I'm glad you mentioned that because that was actually going to be my next question. Discussing the topic of empathy is something that you do a lot in your talks. And empathy, despite having become a buzzword, it's often exercised without concrete actions. And because of that, it becomes an empty process. And of course, audiences should connect emotionally with stories of violence and human rights violations because that's the human thing to do, right?
Exactly.
But is empathy the way to do it? Or does it only reinforce stereotypes? Beyond that, with social media, doom scrolling, innumerable AI videos, and the constant bombarding of information, we are witnessing an even more dehumanizing process in which, in a split of a second, I move on from a news post about what's happening in Gaza to a fake video of cuddling cats. And so, can you help us unpack this scenario a little bit? What are the limits of empathy?
Yeah. Well, empathy, as you said, it's in our nature as a humans. You know, we cannot sympathize or we cannot show empathy to someone else without knowing about their situation. So it's really important for us to mediate a situation in a different area so we can feel in people's pain. So there is a lot of, you know, a lot of articles and research on empathy and the role of media in mediating other people's suffering. So it's not a new question with VR. It has been there, and a lot of scholars discussed the question of empathy. With VR, it became, you know, that it was, you know, the question. VR revived that discussion, but also brought a lot of questions because it's hard these days to talk about virtual reality without talking about empathy, because the whole technology was introduced as an empathy machine by tech companies, especially Mark Zuckerberg. And we know from the history of these companies with extracting people's data for profit that I need to think a little bit more. Do they really care about people's empathy? So for me is first, when you look at all these companies, you see that VR is creating a new venue for them to extract more data. And this time it's not only data, it's emotions and feelings. Because of the sensors that VR headsets have, they can track your eyes, they track, you know, your body movement, they can track everything. They can track everything in your room. And here, as for example, Lisa Nakamura, who published a great article about this. It's called Feeling Good About Feeling Bad. And she criticized that, and she said, like, Meta is using, like, you know, all these companies are using VR as a new way, you know, to get more reviews and to extract people's emotions to make more money and for profit, which is, they are following the same path with social media, right? And this is dangerous because most of the popular VR experiences, the hardware and the software, are coming from these big tech companies. So the issue started, you know, I remember the first time we were asked about empathy, it was at Yale University, when a student said, oh, did you create this project to get people empathy? And for me, it threw us off because as Palestinians, we were all the time asked to get into a stage and perform our pain to convince people that we are human beings like anyone else and deserve some empathy, you know, asking for pity. And it's just like, we reject that notion, you know, just like, if we were dehumanized for a long time, especially in mainstream media. So some people expect that, you know, you need to go there and perform your pain for me so I can get convinced that you are human like me and then I can show you some empathy. So there is a moral question, you know, ethical issue here. And the issue with the audience, if they have that, you know, if they expect us to come to convince them that we are humans like them deserve some empathy, that's the issue, you know, and they need to think about that and they need to solve that. For me, when we created this project, we never thought about it like, you know, to get empathy or whatever. Again, we're creating something to connect with Gaza and build these connections with the people and help with their mobility and resist erasure. But also, the question of empathy comes, right? And we have been collecting data from in surveys from audiences, and usually a lot of people talk about empathy, that, you know, it humanized Palestinians. So first, for me, yes, we have to deal with the empathy question here. It's important and we cannot ignore it and we are not against it. That's we should start here. Mm-hmm. But empathy should not be the end point and the goal itself. It should be a start point for a conversation, for, you know, an experience that to help people accountable. So we need to have a sense of responsibility and accountability. And that cannot, that wouldn't happen if we don't have empathy. So we look at empathy that it should be the start point for this experience. But people should move beyond just, you know, that. Because, you know, if you just put the VR headset and you feel the pain of someone else, you know, the suffering of someone. And just you take off the VR headset. It's just like, oh, I did my part. I felt, you know, I felt in that pain. Lisa Nakamura called the article Feeling Good About Feeling Bad because that's more about the viewer itself. Here, they center their emotions. And just like they did the experience to feel good about feeling bad because they are part of the problem.
Which somehow speaks to this movement I was talking about of doom scrolling, mm-hmm. because there is that possibility of scroll to the next thing and not worry. I don't stay. That pain doesn't stick, mm-hmm. right? It might stick for a minute, but then I move on. And apparently that is possible with VR, but seems to be harder.
Well, yes. So the thing, you know, with social media, you don't control the experience, right? You can scroll, when you're scrolling down, you just like sometimes you find like, I remember during the genocide, and the genocide is still going on, but you know, at that time, you know, when we had like all these videos coming from Gaza, I would go and see like a kid is like, you know, a house is attacked, kids under the rubbles, and I would be like crying. Just when I scroll down, I see like someone is doing a prank or something in the US. So there are like a lot of, emotional confusion. Like, you know, you go from like being sad to being happy to being sometimes, to laugh. And just like there is something crazy because of the algorithms. Mm-hmm. So the algorithms is pushing to you different things. Sometimes they are not organized. And here is like, have like this, contradictions in feelings.
And it allows distraction too.
Exactly. And it of course, like imagine if you are crying because you just watch a video and then just like a funny video comes to you. And it's just like, it kills the moment. It kills that. With VR, it's a little bit different because you can control the experience that you want to see. And you go there to watch something specific. And you cannot spend so much time on VR. Like, the research says the average person can spend 25 to 30 minutes usually on VR. So most people usually when they put the VR headset, they just go and do specific things. So it's not like social media that you algorithms will control everything for you. So it's a little bit different from social media. And from social media, again, you're watching from behind your device. You are not there. You are not immersed. And with virtual reality, you are fully immersed. So just, to wrap it up, we have a book chapter that's coming out soon in fall. And we called that book chapter, Me and Dr. Ahlam, Immersive Media as a Decolonial Art of Confrontation. And our main argument there that, we are using VR should be used or could be used to create a confrontational space where people get confronted with tough realities in different locations. Like because of the powerful, affordances of virtual reality and immersive media in general, we can create this closeness between the viewer and the subject. We can create embodied experience where people can embody someone's, who's going through a tough experience, and they can feel that. But for us, the goal of that, this closeness, this connection, should be used as a confrontational, especially in the context of Gaza, because the whole genocide was enabled by tax money here. It was enabled by the U.S. and has been supported by the U.S. So for us, we wanted the viewers to be confronted with this tough reality and what has happened to that space and that place and to the people because of the support that they have been receiving from here. And you like it or not, you are part of it. And we wanted to have this, confrontational. And that's what I call it, confrontational empathy, where, we are not just showing empathy as an endpoint, but more we have this empathy as a start point to be challenged. At some time, to have this sense of discomfort, because it's fine to feel discomfortable.
And to stick with it.
Exactly. When you are watching a genocide, you will feel discomfort. And this discomfort, it's really important for people so they can, be held accountable and have some sense of responsibility to take an action to stop what's going on. And you can apply this at, for many things and for many experiences. We have a lot of people who are going through, a lot of experiences, tough conditions. Again, like in a different physical location, different now, or even just to go back in time and just revisit one of the issues that we are still, struggling with here in the U.S.
Absolutely. And I look forward to reading this chapter when it comes out. Thank you, Naeem.
Yeah,
and
course.
For the listeners who are just joining us, we are hearing from Dr. Naeem Aburadi, whose research explores the ethical and political dimensions of immersive technologies. We are unfortunately reaching the end of our conversation. So, Naeem, I'd like to ask you, let's shift slightly our focus from society to the classroom. You have recently designed and taught a class about VR here at CU Boulder, in which your students produce their own immersive projects. So my question is, how was this experience for you all? And are there any challenges in discussing and producing immersive technologies within the classroom?
Thank you. So we actually just finished the public showcase for my class like a few days ago. So students did actually 12 immersive projects. For me, the class is called AI, VR, and society. And the idea was how to help students use immersive media, especially 360 filming and some platforms to tell a story for storytelling. Especially to tell stories about, you know, marginalized community or oppressed people. And I was impressed by the amount, like the projects that I saw at the end. They were like amazing, very powerful. And you know, what's, you know, unique about this class is the majority of the students, half of my students are from strategic communication, some of them from media studies, and I just have two students actually from productions, from media production. So the majority of my students never touched the 360 camera or VR headset. So for those students to come to the classroom and just start experimenting with virtual reality, experimenting with 360 filming, with the metaverse, with all of these things, and leave the class with creating a full VR project, that was huge for me. It was very powerful. So, and to give you some examples about how students use that. So, for example, one student she created a 360 documentary about the art, the wall art, about the art on Boulder's walls, the murals. And she picked five, you know, art pieces, about the Black history. And she told that through virtual reality.
Wow.
See, I'm not just there watching. You put the VR headset and you will be, you know, standing against a wall and you just like see this beautiful art with like, you know, storytelling, the story behind you. And another student did a project using a platform. It's called Kula, which is actually a platform for tours. Like, you know, usually people use it like for, you know, real estate, stuff like that. And stuff like that. So the student used that to tell the story of the six Chicano students who were killed here in Boulder in two bombs. So she went and filmed that and added the historical, you know, record and images. And she told the story in a very powerful and a beautiful way. But, you know, other students just made it like for fun. So I have a student who captured his band in the 360 and just wanted to show people like what it means to be, you know, in a band.
Which is great because, as amazing. You mentioned,
exactly.
VR is also a way to capture joy.
Exactly. And history. When the students went to the Red Rocks and did a whole film actually about the history of that location. People go over there for concerts and stuff like that. But sometimes they forget like how that location was created, the history behind it. So the student went there and just created. And imagine if someone, like a lot of people, they cannot come to Boulder or Colorado. So with virtual reality now, they can be immersed in their drugs. They can watch. Actually, he did the sunrise, so you can see the sunrise. And all this amazing. I have a lot, you know, many other projects, like, you know, that captured, for example, the tea house that we have in Boulder here and tells the story about, you know, a historical story. We, different stories. We have art, we have history, we have, you know, stories about, you know, justice and I would, we would never, you know, see, you know, the impact of these projects if we use a different format of media. So with virtual reality, with VR, now you can be immersed, you can, look up, down, right, left. You can walk. You can, you know, bike. You can do all of these things in just with one small action, just to wear a VR headset.
Wow.
And this is important because, and I will end from this, because virtual reality was a great, you know, the main use of virtual reality, according to the research and the surveys, it's gaming. So people usually use virtual reality just to play video games. But for me, the question was how we can decolonize virtual reality and repurpose it to use it in a different way, to tell a story, to visit another location that we cannot visit, to preserve history, to build connection with another culture, to imagine our future. And we cannot do this without the power of immersion and virtual reality and immersive media in general.
Wow, what a great way to finish this conversation. But I am a little bit sad because to be honest, I could talk to you forever. It's been an absolute honor to have you with us today. Thank you for sharing your knowledge, your trajectory, and for reminding us all of the potential and political implications of new technologies.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate that. And I hope that people like the discussion.
Me too.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.